You're listening to However Improbable, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. I'm Sarah Cole.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, we're bringing you our next case file on Sherlock Holmes pastiches, stories that are about Sherlock Holmes and often in Arthur Conan Doyle's style, but not written by him. And who better to talk Holmesian pastiche than Holmesian extraordinaire Lindsay Fay?
Lindsay is an international bestseller and two-time Edgar-nominated author of six critically acclaimed books, including Jane Steele and Gods of Gotham. In addition to her original work, she's the author of her first collection of Sherlock Holmes short stories, The Whole Art of Detection, and Dust and Shadow, a novel that pits Holmes against Jack the Ripper.
We're delighted to chat with Lindsay about her work. Her newest collection of Holmes stories, Observations by Gaslight, is narrated by those who knew the great detective, including beloved characters like Irene Adler and Mrs. Hudson.
Marissa and Lindsay had a really great conversation, and we're going to air that for you now.
We're delighted to chat with Lindsay about her work. Her newest collection of Holmes stories, Observations by Gaslight, is narrated by those who knew the great detective, including beloved characters like Irene Adler and Mrs. Hudson. Thanks for joining us, Lindsay.
It is my pleasure.
So I'm really excited to talk to you. You are obviously such a huge voice in contemporary Holmes pastiches. And I would love to start with how you got interested in Sherlock Holmes and how you began writing pastiches.
Well, one of all, that's very kind of you to say. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're one of our favorites.
Absolutely. Truly kind. I got into Sherlock Holmes when I was about 10. I had already run through all of the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, asked my dad what I should read next. And he was like, well, I'm pretty sure you should read The Adventure of the Speckled Band. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like that one, you're not going to like any of them. So he basically started with like the get-go. He was like, yeah, Speckled Band. You're probably going to like it. If you don't, then I have nothing to say to you. and of course, I loved it. I was about 10 years old. I think when I started reading the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and one of the things that I always find, well, there are two kinds of people in this world. Those who categorize people into two kinds of people and those who don't. but also, those who read The Adventure of the Speckled Band and continue to read every single one of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and those who don't.
Of course.
So I fell into that category of I couldn't stop. And then I discovered that there were also Sherlock Holmes mysteries that weren't even written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And then I was like, oh Lord. He fights dinosaurs. Like, I don't. Then I just turned into a rabid Sherlock Holmes. So that's pretty much how it happened.
When did you discover pastiches?
I'm going to say that my first pastiche was probably Nicholas Meyer's The 7%.
Me too. Yes.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So
that was the first one I encountered. Okay. And then after that, I discovered the internet and I realized that things could get so much better.
Of course. When you started writing Sherlock Holmes stories, were you intending them for publication or were you sort of like, oh, I just got to write this?
What a great question. No, I did not write them for publication in any way. I wrote them because something in my body just compelled me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That makes no sense to
no, I totally get it.
People. But I was just like, oh, I can write Sherlock Holmes stories too. And and then it just kept happening. I never expected anything to happen with any. My first novel, I can say that now because I've written seven, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my first novel, Dust and Shadow. Did I expect it to be published by Simon & Schuster? No. I absolutely did not. And I was more shocked than anybody else, I think.
Well, speaking of Dust and Shadow, which is your novel, your Sherlock Holmes pastiche about the Jack the Ripper killings, was that something that you had already been interested in as a piece of Victorian history and so wanted to figure, like, well, what if Sherlock Holmes was investigating? Like, how did you approach it? How did you come by that topic and want to throw Holmes in that piece of history?
I'm going to throw an unnamed person, because I literally don't remember the name, but I'm going to throw an unnamed person under the bus by saying, I was a waitress at the time, and I have worked in the restaurant business for well over 10 years. I was at, remember when Barnes & Noble existed?
Yeah.
So I walked across the street on my one of my lunch breaks, and as always, perused the mystery section. And I found a Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper novel in which Sherlock Holmes literally had to live in Transylvania. It was not good.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it was awesome. So I was sort of like, yeah. At the same time, I was like, yeah. And I wanted something to exist that hadn't specifically been done before, as far as I could tell. So that was essentially Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper, but all the actual clues. So I consulted. There are Ripperologists just the same as there are Sherlockians.
Right. Like,
they are very, very, very invested in getting stuff right.
Mm-hmm.
And what I hadn't necessarily seen was getting stuff right at the same time that you were also inserting Sherlock Holmes into it. So
right.
that was the motivation, was that I had seen one too many not incredibly accurate Sherlock Holmes mysteries, including Jack the Ripper, and I just really wanted there to be one that did its research.
Totally. Okay. You can really tell, I think, when you read all of your Sherlock Holmes pastiches, how attuned to historical detail they are in the language, in the settings, and then also in the characters. Like the marriage between the historical research and Conan Doyle's voice and the feel of the original stories is just absolutely splendid in your
Thank you.
Pastiches.
That's very sweet of you to say. So
yeah,
thank you.
Relatedly, I would like to talk a little bit about your process. So you do historical research. How do you get into the voice of your characters? Because there is a unique thing about some of your work recently, where your original pastiches, your first couple, Dust and Shadow, and then your first collection of Sherlock Holmes short stories, The Whole Art of Detection, are both largely from Watson's point of view, the sort of familiar Conan Doyle style of narration, and there's a couple that are from Holmes's point of view. But then in your new book, Observations by Gaslight, you approach it from narrators who, some of whom we've never heard before, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is your process in trying to get Watson's, we'll start with Watson's voice, because I think that is really hard. And if you don't get Watson's voice right, then you don't have a strong pastiche. So how do you first get into Watson's head?
Watson's head. Oh my goodness. So the only way that it's possible to get into Watson's head, in my opinion, is Watson saying, quietly to himself, okay, so I'm pretty sure you meant to, no. And Watson's just kind of like, I think what's harder to get into, at the same time that it is sort of my headspace when I write anything pastiche wise regarding Holmes and Watson as traditional, you know, narrators, because I started with both of them and fewer of the Holmes because of the fact that he only writes 2 out of 60 mm-hmm. right. in the canon, right? So it was still kind of like normal at the same time that it was clearly pretty humorous and also kind of like, really, Holmes, really.
Right. Well, it's such a delight in the whole art of detection when you do the Sherlock Holmes narration, because it is so unusual to get that point of view, but also I think you do a lot more fun things with it than Conan Doyle himself does. Because, yeah, the original Conan Doyle Holmes point of view stories are a little bit difficult.
They are. They're a little hard to swallow. Mm-hmm. And so when I approached it canonically at the same time that I approached it, I was like, no, Holmes doesn't really sound like this. I think that ultimately it's harder to write Holmes as he actually is, as opposed to Holmes as he pretends to be, and Holmes as he explains himself in public. And he's just like, well, I don't have feelings. And I don't, you know, I don't have any feelings about this or this or this or
right.
Then he's just covered in feelings and you're just like, mm-hmm.
I want to circle back around to this topic in a minute, because I think what you do with the Irene Adler narration in Observations by Gaslight really hones in on this.
Thank you. Right? Yeah, he's covered in feelings and he's just like, feelings!
Yeah.
And she's like, I really don't know what to do with this.
Exactly. And she's so effusive.
Mm-hmm.
And he is completely trying to be the opposite. But what I really love about it is their common ground that they have.
That was fun yeah. to write.
Mm-hmm. So in your process of getting ready to write these stories and to get into the voice of these characters, especially in Observations by Gaslight, if we can move on to that book, how did you approach characters from, you know, Irene Adler to Mrs. Hudson to some of these characters that are so exceedingly minor and really don't have a voice in the canon?
I approached it from, so a couple of the characters that were really minor, like I had already written for other publications, and I had said to them, yes, I will write you a Sherlock Holmes story. No, it will not be from the point of view of Dr. Watson or Sherlock Holmes. Is that okay? And very kindly, those publications said, sure. So that had already happened. Most of the, well, Observations by Gaslight is entirely a new collection in the sense that not only are some of the stories just brand new, but many of the stories, every single one of them actually, has been expanded by a lot of words. Like, because every once in a while, people were asking me to write for a magazine, say, and it was a very hard line of like, you know, 4,500 words. And for this, I just expanded it to the best of my ability to do. At the same time, I think that what's most actually, I don't want to say important,
But what I tried to focus on when I was writing Observations by Gaslight was that everybody comes at Sherlock Holmes from a different perspective. And the people who knew him, who literally, canonically, knew him, you know, quote unquote, they would have known him best of all. And Holmes is a giant liar.
Yes, absolutely.
Constantly.
He's an actor, yes, right? You. I mean, that's all he does, is he puts on shows, little shows all the time.
Yeah, most of the shows are everyone look at me in giant capitals and subtitle, Watson, mm-hmm. look at me. Are you looking at me? Great. That is basically what Holmes does. And so to sort of, I don't know, rephrase that into other people who are also watching him being ridiculous, it was really fun. And it gave me a much wider opportunity to have different narrative voices, as opposed to trying to be Dr. Watson or trying to be Sherlock Holmes.
Well, I think part of what is so delightful about Observations by Gaslight is that it offers new ways into looking at the many facets of Holmes's personality, because you get sometimes contrasting perspectives. If you look at Lestrade and other mm-hmm. members of the police force that you take up in the stories, or if you look at was it Wiggins, right, in of the mm-hmm. Baker Street Irregulars, but then you get Mrs. Hudson and Irene Adler. There's just so many facets of his personality, none of which are one isn't more true than the other necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just different parts of him that you aren't going to get. You're not going to get the same Sherlock Holmes from Irene Adler and Inspector Lestrade.
Exactly. And that was definitely what I was trying for, was that you're going to get the genuine experience that you had with this completely banana pants person. But at the end of the day, that's not the only experience. And it became sort of an experiment for myself as well, just trying to see how other people saw Sherlock Holmes.
Right. So when you were approaching your narrative voice, are you trying to... To what degree are you trying to emulate Arthur Conan Doyle? Because I feel like there is a degree to which it really does feel so much like the canon, but I can also, your voice comes through as well in a way that I think is completely wonderful, and it allows the stories to feel very canon and Victorian with also having a sort of modern sensibility. So is your process trying to get as close to Conan Doyle as possible, or are you just taking Conan Doyle's tool set and then approaching it with your own narrative voice?
What a good question. It used to be when I was writing Dust and Shadow, for instance, I really had been reading so many pastiches, and I had seen so many of them, and I had just, you know, I had come to the conclusion, I was like, I can do that. So at the time, yeah, I was definitely trying to emulate to the best of my possible skill set Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I think also in the whole Art of Detection, that collection of short stories, I was also trying to emulate Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in the best way that I possibly could. By the time, because I've been doing this for a hot minute, by the time I got to Observations by Gaslight, I had written so many other original characters that I was bored. And I wasn't bored with Charlotte Conan Doyle, because I never will be, ever. But I was asking myself actively, can't you write new characters from new perspectives that that are also relevant to the way we see these people and the way we tell these stories? So by the time I got to Observations by Gaslight, I was specifically saying to myself, I deeply want to continue doing this, and I'm not going to keep doing it just from Sherlock Holmes' perspective or from Dr. Watson's perspective at all. And I started telling people when I was writing for magazines and, you know, random collections, I started telling people, yeah, I would be delighted to write something for you, but it's not from the direct perspective of John Watson.
That's so interesting. I mean, that's such a great answer. It's just, it's interesting to think about how your writing has progressed over time and evolved when you are still within the same world.
I deeply wanted to remain in the same world at the same time that I was like, I can't keep writing this perspective, right? And I can't keep writing the same story over and over again. And so it turned into I'm going to keep writing the same story over and over again, but somebody else is going to tell it.
Right. Well, part of the joy of pastiches is that it allows you to do different things with the canon, and that I think you can't fully enjoy a pastiche unless you are versed with the canon. So I'm wondering, when you approach a new story, whether that is in your most recent collection or in The Whole Art of Detection, is there any facet of the canon that you are looking to revise or fill in? For example, I find that your stories are a lot more character-driven, and characters are more, I don't want to say more willing to show their emotions, because I think that suggests that, you know, that it isn't mimicking Conan Doyle, because I think it is, but I think that you are more attuned to the character's emotions than perhaps Conan Doyle wanted to display explicitly on page. So is that something that you're interested in when you're writing pastiche stories?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you were to like put my pastiches on a wall and like throw a dart at it, you probably couldn't nail the dart without it having something to do with Reichenbach. And how dare you?
Yeah, totally, totally, totally.
Yeah. So Reichenbach and how dare you is a big chunk of pastiches. Whereas,
yes.
Nope. Did a bad job. So yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I also think that Arthur Conan Doyle, at the time, he was going through a lot himself, and he also deeply hated writing the Sherlock Holmes,
right?
So I mean, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, mine tends to have feelings. where some of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle perfect, wonderful Holmes mysteries may not have as many things. And that is completely okay. At the same time, yeah, that is
something that probably differentiates mine from the, you know, original real product.
Right. Well, what I really like too about the whole art of detection is the way that even though you are so close to the canon, you still play with it a lot. So, for example, in, I think it's the short story in Empty House, where it is Watson's diary entries and also his writing process. So you see him crossing things out and editing and revising as he goes along. I think that's, it lets people get beyond the page of this character of, like, Dr. Watson, who is publishing these stories in the Strand, to the quote-unquote real Dr. Watson.
Yeah.
And gives you an insight into who he is as a character and also what he's going through and what he does and doesn't put on the published page.
It's so interesting that you bring this up because of the fact that, like, I've had this conversation with multiple people, and I insist that there is no meta more meta than Sherlock Holmes being aware of the fact that Dr. Watson is writing about him in the Strand, right?
Yeah.
That is true. Totally. That is so hardcore meta that you that you can't you can't get past it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, they comment on these things, like, constantly. And so whenever I do something meta, you can't get more meta than Sherlock Holmes being aware of the fact that he's being written about in the Strand. And that is pretty much when he got famous, and that's pretty much when he's now a rock god. You're welcome. And Dr. Watson, like, drops mic.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that you're totally right. I mean, it's a sort of nesting doll mm-hmm. after a while, right? It's just stories within stories within stories, and it makes you think about, well, who is writing this, and why are they acting this way, and what is on the page, what isn't on the page?
I quote this constantly, and, like, apologies to everyone who's heard this before, because you have already heard this before, but Michael Chabon, who is brilliant, wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. His essay collection starts with an essay called Fan Fiction on Sherlock Holmes. And you can only guess how hardcore I was into that. So he essentially said, all novels are sequels. And that's true. At the end of the essay, all novels are sequels. And bliss. That's such a good thing to say. Because anybody who has ever tried to pretend that they were coming up with something new and brilliant, they're lying. They came up with something because they already loved something else.
I want to pivot a little bit to some of the female characters in your stories
mm-hmm.
and in the novel. Remind me of the character in Dust and Shadow that they solved the mystery with. Her name?
Marianne Monk. She was a real, she was a real person. I get accused.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I get accused of having created a Mary Sue.
I wasn't going to say that at all, but...
Well, of course not. But I get accused every once in a while
mm-hmm.
of having created a Mary Sue. And my two answers are, one of all, she was a real person. And two of all, yeah, I created a Mary Sue. And his name is John Watson.
Yes. Yes. Right. So who was she in real life then?
She was someone who did an interview, I think, deposed by the police, and she was just near the crime scenes at the time.
That's fascinating. So did you come across her in your research mm-hmm. and decided to incorporate her
yes.
into the novel? That's awesome. I didn't know that. Because she has resonances of Kitty Winter a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Were you, when you were working on her character, incorporating both the historical research that you were engaged in, and then also embellishing her as a fictional version of this woman, did you return to the canon stories, return to the female characters that you felt fit her character?
I frequently do that when I'm writing something along the lines of, this is an early case, so I'm going to read the Redheaded League first,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm just going to get the cadence of it in my head. Or this is a later case, and I'm going to read The Illustrious Client and get that cadence in my head, because it's very different. Obviously, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was not the same age when he was writing these very wonderful short stories. But specifically with Marianne Monk, I didn't have anybody specifically set in mind other than the fact that I wanted someone who represented the real people who were actually there. And so as much as possible, I tried to make her voice original. Probably I didn't succeed very well, but I certainly attempted to make her be, you know, just a unique individual who is caught in the crossfire.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that she really does ground the novel a lot.
Oh, thank you.
But I was also curious, because I think that you can see in a lot of your pastiches, you do center female characters in a way that, although Conan Doyle has a plethora of female characters, mm-hmm. you really give them like a well-rounded personality, and they don't feel shoehorned, you know? They feel much like living, breathing people. And I'm wondering if, like, yeah. Well, and I'm curious because, you know, of course, not only your very sort of typical Victorian prejudices, but the way that Holmes himself is almost a self-described misogynist occasionally, even though the way he interacts with women is genuinely very kind and courteous.
That's exactly the problem, because yes, thank you for bringing this up. Like, he describes himself as being a nasty bro, and like,
mm-hmm.
I don't really want to get anywhere near that. And at the same time, if you threaten a woman in Sherlock Holmes's presence, he's like, I will kill you. Like, immediately Sherlock Holmes mm-hmm. is like, I'm sorry, did you threaten a woman? I'm pretty sure that you're about to be dead. And Watson's like holding him back. Like,
right.
The way Sherlock Holmes describes himself is so, so far away from the way Sherlock Holmes actually acts. And I think that actually one of the things that I really try to do when I'm writing pastiches is to describe Sherlock Holmes the way he is, as opposed to the way he describes himself, because it's always bullshit.
Well, and I think you do that a lot in Observations by Gaslight, right? Like, that's sort of the conceit of the book.
Yeah.
But that gets back around to what I was saying earlier,
mm-hmm.
that connection between him and Irene Adler, even though they have quite different personalities and goals and perspectives on things, that they really do share this core similarity between the two of them. And I think it's so fascinating in pastiches or adaptations when you see Holmes relate to women on such a deep level. And I'm wondering if that is part and parcel of that relationship between him and Irene. Not that it's romantic, but that they share some sort of core sense of self.
Oh, exactly. Like, I had such a good time writing that bro TP
Like, it
yes.
was, like, they're just like,
exactly.
Awesome. We have a handshake. Great. like, I had so much fun writing that. In no way, you know, like, romantically realized or even imagined, because mm-hmm. Holmes is just kind of like, yeah, you're awesome, and she's just like, I am awesome, you're welcome, right. But like, it was really, really fun to write because of the fact that, like, I don't know, people tend to have, I don't know, there are adaptations of Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler that romanticize the relationship mm-hmm. in ways that I don't particularly see. So my version was just sort of like, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I kicked that guy. It was great, you know?
It's fantastic. And she's so in love with her husband, which I'm like, yes, that is the point of A Scandal in Bohemia. She loves her husband and he loves her and they're great together.
That is the entire point of A Scandal in Bohemia. And anybody who ignores that is just sort of like, I get it. But I question, I'm like, did you read that story? Because,
right.
Because she's really stupidly in love with her husband. And I read
Norton, what a guy.
Yeah. And I read that story and I'm pretty sure it hasn't changed.
Right. And I think, not to get into this whole side tangent, but I think there is so much to explore in terms of queer representations of Holmes in that relationship between him and Irene, where there is this connection that he has with women occasionally. That is so fascinating.
With her brain.
And yeah, exactly.
And he's just like, oh, buddy.
Mm. Right, they like had that brainwave going on
mm-hmm.
together.
Well, that's how I see them.
No, I think that totally tracks. Like, I completely agree. And I think that it was such a wonderful, it's so fun, you know, when you get the chance to explore that relationship a little bit more. Sarah and I are always talking about how fun it would be to have the Richie Holmes trio do little side adventures together.
That would be cute.
Little crew. Yeah.
Oh, that would be real nice. I mm-hmm. would also appreciate that.
Right.
I would appreciate as well the Asylum Sherlock Holmes just doing more movies. Ben Sider can be Sherlock Holmes forever as far as I'm concerned.
So in terms of looking forward, I have a couple quick questions about things in the future. First off, Sherlock Holmes is going public domain, I think, next year in the United States completely.
Oh, all of it. Yeah. Although it already was kind of, I've been down that rodeo pony show.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you have any, I mean, do you think that'll affect your writing at all?
Oh, no. No. I can pretty much get away with anything.
Fantastic. So, that's what we like to hear.
Also, everyone else kind of can too. Ever since, so if you want to reference this, definitely don't quote me on it, but Leslie Klinger and Laurie R. King, Free Sherlock. Google that, and pretty much anything is fair game, and it has been for a while.
Yeah, because there's so much I would still love to see, despite the fact that it's been done a million times, but, you know, there's more. I want more. I always want more.
Of course. Yes, and, the thing that you can't do is stuff that is under copyright regarding things along the lines of BBC Sherlock, right? Or Elementary starring Johnny Lee, or, you know, like, you can't do that because that is definitely under copyright. But the character of Sherlock Holmes, do what you want.
Do what you want. I encourage everyone to do what they want with him.
Oh, yeah.
So is there anything coming out or anything on the horizon that you are interested in or excited about in terms of Sherlock Holmes? It seems like there's been a little resurgence again of Holmes media, like Enola Holmes and the Baker Street Irregular show, or anything more like recently that you've been particularly interested in.
I mean, I'm always just sort of like gobbling up any Sherlock Holmes content that I can like come by. But you know what I go to regarding whether or not they have read it yet, because too few people have read it, and by God, the first book in the series and the second book in the series are both fan-bloody-tastic. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse is his co-writer.
There's a Mycroft Holmes book.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's outstanding.
Okay, awesome.
And
I have not read this yet.
And I refuse to endorse Sherlock Holmes related content, because if I did, it would be the only thing that I do ever. However, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote the best two Sherlock Holmes pastiches, along with Anna Waterhouse, from the perspective of Mycroft Holmes, ever to happen.
That's so exciting, because Sarah and I were just talking about Mycroft, because we've just covered the Greek interpreter, and then we're doing a mini case file on Mycroft and how he has evolved in adaptations. Like, he's always like mildly to extremely antagonistic weirdly.
Is a whole new perspective.
Exciting. We will have to look into that and read those, because he's such a like weird little character. He looms so large despite appearing so seldomly.
Did Stephen Fry ever play Mycroft Holmes? Because if he did.
In the second Guy Ritchie movie.
I think probably Stephen Fry would be my pick.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. He's very close to how I picture Mycroft. And he's just so, like, you really buy the intelligence, but then also the camaraderie and the weirdness between him and Holmes.
And he's just like, I'm just going to stay here and be weird. You're okay. You're just going to do that. Oh, all right. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed Stephen Fry. And would like to see him back again.
Well, thank you, Lindsay, for coming on and talking with us. This is such a delight. We've been such fans of your work for so long. It was so exciting to get a chance to sit down and talk with you.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure. And thank you for reading my stuff in the first place. That's very...
Yeah. We very look sweet. Forward in the future to maybe more stuff whenever, you know, no pressure, but whenever you get around to it, we'll definitely be buying.
Well, thank
you. Yeah. Is there anywhere where people can find you online or purchase your books?
I always recommend going to your local bookseller and just saying, I would like these particular books. So there's that. And here in New York, you can always order things from the Strand, which is topical as well.
Well, thank you again so much. This was really a delight.
Oh, it was very nice to meet you. Thank you.
You too. When did you first read Lindsay Fay?
I honestly feel like I discovered her work sort of later than probably a lot of other Holmes story lovers. And I think it was because I was a little, this sounds silly, I was a little intimidated because I had only heard good things and I was like, what if I don't like it and I'm the odd one out and I'm not going to like get this person who everyone says her stuff is so great. So I can't think of a specific year, but of course I read Dust and Shadow first. And of course, I was like, well, this is like the best Holmes pastiche ever written. I don't know what my problem was about this. was. And I have since read her older book of short stories. I actually haven't read the new book yet, but I really enjoyed listening to your interview about it. Yeah, what about you? When was your first experience reading?
I also read Dust and Shadow first, I believe, and then was immediately like, oh my God, I must read the short story collection that exists. And I absolutely loved it. Both of those books are really comfort reads for me, and I've reread both of them a couple times. And they're always delightful. I always enjoy, there's always stories that are highlights to me in different parts of my life where, you know, last time I read it, I really enjoyed all the post Reichenbach Fall stories. You know, the first time I read it, I really enjoyed the stories in which Holmes is telling Watson about his early cases. So there's always stories that stand out to me for different reasons. One that always is my favorite is the one in which, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of the story off the top of my head. I'm sure I talk about it in our conversation, but the one in which Watson is writing his diary entries and is also at the same time editing his own story about Sherlock Holmes that is right before The Adventure of the Empty House. It might even be called An Empty House. And that short story actually might be called An Empty House. And I really love that one because I think it does what it showcases what Lindsay is really good at, which is both capturing Watson's voice, which, as we've talked about in previous episodes about pastiches, is probably the most important thing in writing a Sherlock Holmes pastiche. Because if you don't get Watson right, you don't get anything about the Holmes world right. But at the same time, while really capturing that period and that voice, pushing against Conan Doyle in a way where it feels more modern, it feels like she's being a little bit more creative in either the format of the style that she's writing or is a little bit more up to date in terms of the female characters that she's writing.
Yeah, I think one of the things I have really admire in her pastiche writing is I think it's the perfect balance between emulation and improvement. And sometimes, like, there are some pastiche writers out there who just really nail writing, sounding exactly like Doyle and having the stories feel like Doyle. And then there are people who are building on the world or arguing with the world or challenging it. And I think her work does both, which is a really, really hard balance to strike, where particularly her Watson voice, but also, like, the stories in the short story collection that are from Holmes's perspective, which we've talked about on this podcast. I think Doyle doesn't write Holmes's point of view very well. He's very dry. And
I love everything she writes from Holmes's perspective. I really think she understands Holmes as a character, how much of an actor he is in all things.
Yes. which is a pivotal character point that sometimes I think gets dropped a little bit in the short stories that are from Holmes's perspective. You kind of miss Watson's voice a little bit. And I don't feel that way about her pastiches where we're in Holmes's head. So that's, you know, just sort of a concrete writing example of taking something stylistically that Doyle does that's so and making it so much better and so much more fulfilled and so much more exciting to read. Yeah, it's really well done.
It is. Everything I've read by her has been thoroughly enjoyable, and I'm always looking forward to new things that she writes in the Holmesian world. Yes.
Yeah, do you want to talk at all between us about what she does with women in the canon? It's something I also really admire.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that you and I have definitely talked about in the past is Lindsay's ability to write women in a very compelling way, and that is reminiscent of the canon, but also much more embellished and not as flat of characters as Conan Doyle tends to write. He has some good female characters, but then there's also, as we have thoroughly discussed, a lot of latent sexism embedded into his writing. I think that Lindsay's female characters in the short stories, and particularly in Dust and Shadow, which I didn't know was based off of a real person, which is just fascinating.
Yeah, I know.
I think that not only does that do the job of, you know, allowing women to exist with agency in the Holmesian world and in this time period, but also does the job of what I find really interesting about Holmes's interactions with women is that he always tends to find this surprising comradeship with them. You know, there's always this, equal footing that he is surprised to be found upon in his relationship with interesting women, whether that's Irene Adler or, you know, Kitty Winter or Marianne Monk. I always find that very compelling. What about Lindsay's female characters do you like?
Well, you know, I think I'm glad you said Kitty Winter's name, because I think Kitty Winter is sort of like the best of Doyle's female characters. Mm-hmm. Irene Adler is also up there. But there are a lot of them that are not as well-rounded and as interesting and as complicated as those women are. There are some that get close so that you can understand why we want to care about them, but sometimes he phones it in. And I feel, not to like be shady, but sometimes I feel pastiche writers go one direction and not the other and let their women feel very two-dimensional. And I think in all of her short stories and in Dust and Shadow, like you said, in particular, her female characters are as good as the best Doyle's female characters are. Yes. Which just shows to, like, you know, it's something that the stories need. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of women in the Holmes canon stories. Right. There are.
Mm-hmm.
And people seem to sort of willfully forget them. And having that presence done really well all the time, I think, really elevates her body of work.
Oh, the other thing that I wanted to mention is her emphasis on emotional arcs and characters and the relationships with one another, that I think you can, what you're looking for in a pastiche, or at least what I'm looking for in a pastiche, let me be clear, is filling in the holes that the canon doesn't provide. So if I just want to read a nice little, like, succinct mystery, I can read something like The Red-Headed League, which just a great little strange story, right? But if I want to feel like emotionally satisfied, I'm going to go to Lindsay Fay. You know, like, I'm going to go to all the post-empty house things that she writes about in the whole Art of Deduction. Or I'm going to go into this new collection, Observations by Gaslight, and dig into all the complexity between Holmes and Lestrade, for example. And that's where you're really going to get the nuances of those personalities and the tensions in those characters. Because although that is, I think, hinted at in the canon, it's not really explored in any sort of depth.
Yeah, I think she's really talented at pinpointing what's fascinating about the dynamics between characters and pulling it out and putting it onto the page of pastiche, which is the joy of pastiche, is that it gives you space to, like, go, what if we looked really, really specifically at what this one line in this one story might imply? Why not? That's, you know, that's what it's for, and that's the joy of it and why we enjoy it so much. And I'm totally with you where I think why I choose to read pastiche is not to read a well-plotted mystery necessarily, even though I certainly enjoy a well-plotted mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to read people's takes on how the characters are feeling, because Doyle doesn't always tell us.
Right.
And that's just his style, and that's just, for lots of different reasons, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanisms of having Watson publishing these stories to the public, I mean, invites all sorts of interesting potential for people approaching these things from different angles to, like, actually let us know how Watson or Holmes or Irene Adler or Lestrade, like you said, how they're feeling. And it's always so much fun, and it's done so well in everything that she writes. It's like a delight every time.
Yes. And I mean, I think that makes so much sense, because that is why, for example, the 7% solution and The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes are so popular, is because they, you know, they pull back the curtain and show you who these people were, you know, and they show you the real emotional lives of these characters in a way that the canon doesn't do and doesn't need to do, I think, because it's the job of pastiche writers, and it's the job of the world that we as readers have built around these characters to fill in those gaps.
And I think that's the fun thing about reading a body of work like Holmes pastiche in general, particularly when there are such talented writers like Lindsay Fay playing around in it, is you get to read other people's interpretations of those dynamics. And sometimes you don't always necessarily even agree with them, but it's just fun to see what people are thinking is happening behind the scenes, which is why Holmes pastiche is such a gold mine of stuff.
Right. There's no right or wrong answer. There's just so different takes.
Bottled up tension.
Yes, it's the best.
Particularly in some of the stories we're getting to. Mm-hmm. And I can read a post-empty house story 1,000 times and never be unhappy with it.
Ugh, just
personally,
the most delectable.
The angst.
The angst. Ugh, the drama.
thank you so much for tuning in. And if you haven't read any of Lindsay Fay's work, we encourage you to go read everything she's ever written. We're obviously really big fans, if that wasn't obvious from the interview and our conversation. We'll put some links to where you can find her work to buy and some more information in the show notes so you can go get yourself a copy of Dust and Shadow if you don't have one yourself. Join us next time for our narration of the novella, The Sign of Four. Yes, we're finally getting there. You can send your thoughts to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website, howeverimprobablepodcast.com, has got transcripts, the research behind the episode, and suggestions for further reading. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.